and welcome to Mental Health Insights. My name is Craig, and I'm here with Stephanie Barbie today. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Craig.
So this is actually going to be a really unique opportunity. Whenever Stephanie and I were talking, even before we started recording here, we're talking about all the different topics that Stephanie loves to talk about. And I really feel like we kind of hit on a strand when you're talking with me about some of the, where all the work that you do, where it kind of coalesces, where it meets together, this common thread, where you help people understand their relationships from an attachment framework, which is something we talked a little bit about, and we can most certainly talk more about today. And you really help people like find and explore and understand more about their own identity. And I want to, I know that right now there's a lot of people that may be listening to this that they ask the question, like, who am I? Or they're wondering about their own identity right now. And give me a sense, whenever someone's coming to you and they may be like, hey, I don't really know who I am. Or you kind of identify that, hey, if they have a little more understanding or knowledge about their identity, this may be helpful for them. What do you do to kind of start them on that process?
So really, I start with understanding the person. So, you know, sometimes we get so used to being surface level in our interactions with people. And it just kind of gets, it becomes a part of us, right? So it's like, how are you doing? Good. Oh, but I'm really not good. I'm really terrible. I'm really feeling very sad, or I'm feeling very anxious, or whatever those real feelings are. And so I start off by really listening to how a person is talking about themselves and their experiences to give me kind of clues as to where they are. And then we start to process where they want to be. And that's how we start.
All right. So talk to me a little more about like the surface level, right? I think that that term is probably something that's similar for us counselors whenever, but someone who's listening to this may be like, wait, what do you mean by surface level? Tell me a little bit about maybe how to help people understand the difference between surface level and maybe like a deeper level of talking about things.
Yeah, so I like to think about surface level as kind of if I was at the grocery store and I met the store clerk, and I'm not going to really want to divulge my life story to this individual, so I'm going to keep it very kind of socially polite, if you will.
Right.
Just very much, hi, I'm okay, I'm fine, or whatever. A deeper level for me is really kind of unmasking, is how I like to refer to it. So being able to be in that space where you're able to really get in touch with where you are on that emotional level. So whether you're, like I said, feeling sad, okay, what are you feeling sad about? Or is it something deeper than sadness? Are you feeling sadness, or are you feeling despair? Are you feeling anger? Are you feeling irritation? What are you really feeling so that we can kind of get to those roots?
So are you saying whenever I talk to people about the weather, I may be on kind of a more surface level conversation?
Absolutely.
I think that this is so important because I think that so many of us get used to that surface level conversation, right? And the thing that I think of most often, I don't know why this is, whenever I would come home from school or whenever I'd see parents, whenever they see their kids get home from school, what's the first thing they ask them? How was your day at school? Right? What does the kid say? 100% of the time. Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
Did you learn anything at school? Yeah. Okay. It's like, are you saying that you went to school for 7 hours and you didn't learn anything? Like, and are you saying that every day that you go to school, like everything is just fine? But like, that's that surface level conversation. It's almost like our automatic or our polite. Is that what you said? The polite, like the responses and like the polite conversation. So being able to help somebody move past that surface level is, and then have an idea of where it is that they're wanting to go.
Yes.
So give me an idea. How might you help someone determine where they might want to go, or like what the type of person that they might want to be is?
So I really like to start off by, so my philosophy is that you come to me whole and I just help you figure out the pieces, right? And so all that you need is already there. It's just all jumbled up sometimes. And so being that said, if you have all the pieces, you're bringing it to me. And as you're talking, I'm kind of mentally sorting those pieces. And so I am taking what you're telling me and I'm kind of, we're kind of on a journey together of, okay, this is where you are. And I'm hearing that that's not where you want to be. What does your ideal self look like? If you were content, because I don't like to say happy all the time, but especially in the climate we're in now, but if you were content in life and if you were content with in this moment, what would that look like? What things would you need and what things would you need to get rid of?
Right, right. So I think of this in some ways where like I do a lot of couples work, right? So a lot of times where it might be, well, what are some of the things you wish that you could say to your spouse, or what are some things that you know, you wish you could disclose or divulge that would make things a lot easier or anything. So like that would be different things where you're wondering to kind of help them get more towards like that idea that they may have of who they want to be.
Yes.
Is that right? Yes. So what happens when you guys have a good picture of that? When it's like, okay, like we have a good idea of where you want to be. We kind of know where you're at now. What happens next?
Well, then the real work begins, right? So therapeutically, that's when we start digging in. That's when we start unlearning the things that have enabled you to get to this place. So what has it been in your journey that when you got to this spot, you're like, okay, I'm not really okay, but I'm good enough to not have done the work before or not right. have come to therapy, sat in this space, really brought that awareness to myself and my surroundings. Why have I never put in boundaries before? Why have I never explored why I keep having these types of relationships? You know, all of these things that become patterns for us, what do I have to unlearn? And that's really the hardest part of it.
I love that you use that word unlearn, right? I think that so many of us, like, so the brain is constantly changing. It's constantly wiring and rewiring and everything like that. And there's so much truth to that, that sometimes that we learn different things that make us start to think or see things in a certain way. I actually talked to someone else about this not too long ago. I talked to Pete about this in a podcast. We were talking about men in counseling and some of the challenges that they face, and about how culture kind of indoctrinates us in a certain way that like, hey, showing emotions, talk about your feelings is not always okay. And I imagine that has to be much like that for some of the things that whenever you see clients like, hey, this is the spot where you want to be, this is where you're at right now, there are certain things that you're going to have to unlearn. So then you can relearn how to do something else to actually get to that place. Like if you want yourself to be a, you know, more jovial person, or if you want yourself to be a more vulnerable or open person, then you have to unlearn some of the things that are keeping you from that. Like whether or not it's the fear that things are going to go wrong, or it's just that, hey, I'm only used to talking to people at a surface level, or anything like that. I wonder, what do you kind of notice is it like for people whenever they start unlearning some of these things? What is it like for them?
Well, it's an extremely vulnerable place to be in, because you are essentially saying that what I have known is not what's best for me, or what may work for my mom, my aunt, my best friend isn't necessarily what's going to be best for me. And so it's really, I kind of explain it in this way of, you know, kind of talking back to those neural pathways in the brain. I kind of explain it like it's a trench, right? And so if you go the same path every time, you dig this trench deeper and deeper and deeper. And so if you want to go a different way, of course you're going to have to take a lot longer to build that trench as deep and as wide as that one that you are unlearning. And so it's going to come with mistakes. It's going to come with challenges. And it's really about being graceful with yourself, having a lot of self-compassion.
Are you saying this doesn't happen like the first time where it's like, all right, I want to unlearn this and try something different? It isn't just one and done?
Man, I wish. Well, no, I don't wish, but I'm sure people wish, right? It's not that simple. And it's actually really, really challenging, but it's worth it, right? Because what we don't often realize is that there is something on the other side of what we're used to. And it's not always bad. In most cases, it's actually really very beautiful.
Right. Right. So you mentioned that you may start to recognize during this journey that, like, hey, what's worked for mom, dad, aunt, other family members, siblings, it doesn't really quite work for me. So I wonder, this is kind of where I want to kind of bring that like attachment piece into this. What do you feel that, because like our attachment is such a huge part of our identity. So at what point does this start to come into play with some of the work that you're in? Like, hey, we need to start looking at some of these relationships and things that are going on. Give me an idea of that.
So even though I may not always formally assess for it, I'm always listening for what those attachments have been like. I might ask you about what was your relationship like with your mom? What was your relationship with your dad? How, what types of good memories do you have with either of those? Or if you don't have any, what types of relationships did you have with that primary care person? When you were sad or vulnerable, who could you go to for comfort? Some of those things start to dig at in those earlier stages. How were you learning to seek comfort? How were you learning to protect yourself? And how is that showing itself in this new adult form?
And how were you learning your identity? How are you learning about who you are? So like when you're talking about unlearning, it's digging those new trenches and trying to make it so that it's easier to go that way. And sometimes it's going really against what you've grown up learning. And absolutely. I feel like I kind of want to give an example here. So this might've been an example that I've given before too. It's like, let's say that whenever I've grown up, everybody's always told me I'm smart, like, man, you're quick as whip, all these different types of things. And because of that, I'm like, I have to show that I'm smart, right? So I'm studying all the time and I'm trying to do like all these things all the time because I got to prove how smart I am. Mm-hmm. And that comes with a lot of stress. That comes with like, I'm pulling my hair out. I'm studying for tests all the time and I got to do well in my job and career because if not, then I may not be as smart as everybody thinks that I am. And if I'm sitting there and I'm like, gosh, like I'm just so tired of feeling like I always have to prove myself. I'm so sick of feeling like everybody's always watching me and it's almost like they're waiting for me to mess up. Mm. Right. And if I take a look at that and I start to be like, oh my gosh, it feels like that because my whole life people have treated me like I was super smart and that because I'm super smart, I should be super successful. And it has made it for me that it's not okay to fail. That it has not been okay to ask questions or it's not been okay to be uncertain about things. It helps us see why we've built up the habits and the kind of sometimes personality traits or the, just the automatic way that we do things. And it gives us an opportunity to try something just a little bit different and understanding like how people have given us those messages. I wonder, does that sound right for you?
Absolutely. And you know, that the word that sticks out to me as you're talking is that should, right? And so I tell my clients often, stop shoulding on yourself, because it is so it's so heavy to place that burden of should on yourself. And so if I could, I would. And if I'm not, there's a reason. And so finding out the reason is a lot more productive than kind of staying in the should cycle.
Right. I think about like whenever I do my couples work and everything where, couples will start to realize over time, like, hey, you know what? I know that things would probably be a lot easier or a lot better if I just started talking about my feelings, or if I just started talking about what was going on with me more often. And that, you know, my spouse isn't going to be as angry or as unresponsive as I thought they were going to be, especially as they kind of get into, couples counseling a little more, and they kind of realize that like, hey, they want to be here with me and they love me and they care about me too. But it's hard. Those, some of these things are really ingrained in us, and we learn how to protect ourselves. Like you said, we learn how to protect ourselves, and sometimes it's really hard to kind of like, it's really hard to rationalize with ourselves that, hey, like, I'll take this off. And then sometimes we can rationalize it, but it's really hard to still actually do it. Yeah. I was actually thinking of a session that I had not too long ago where I was talking to a client about something. I was like, man, this is perfect. Actually, can you just sit here and actually talk back to me about, you know, this feeling? This feeling of fear, this feeling of sadness, or whatever it is that we were talking about. And we've been talking about it for like 10 minutes, and he's like, oh yeah, sure. And then he goes to do it, and then something stops him, right? Because he learned at some point that it's not okay to show your feelings. It's not okay to talk about this. And even in that moment that was showing up for him, so like whenever you're talking about like this identity work and everything, and like, how it's connected to this attachment. One of the things you might look at is like, hey, well, what is it that's keeping you from speaking this? And we kind of know where you want to go with this. Like, we need to figure more out about this and actually unlearn that part of us that tells us that it's not okay. Am I getting that right?
Absolutely. And it's so you're unlearned. It's a twofold, right? So I'm unlearning and I'm also learning something new. And right. So I'm having to take calculated risks to put my foot out there and really be vulnerable, because the truth is I don't know how someone is going to respond to this new way of me being, especially if I'm used to being this other way, right? And so I have to prepare you for that. I have to prepare you for the fact that everyone may not like it, and everyone might not, you know, respond in the way that you think that they should. And let's talk about that separately, but at the same time, which is more important for you?
Right. So I want to kind of bring in some of the work that I know that you do. And one of the things I know that you do is you enjoy working with pregnant mothers and the different challenges that come along with that. And I can only imagine how important that identity and that attachment piece has to be with them.
Oh man, it's so important. And at the same time, it's so heartbreaking sometimes, honestly, because oftentimes women may not realize that they have attachment challenges until they enter that attachment relationship with their child.
Right.
And so it's that postpartum period where they're like, oh my God, I don't know how to respond to this creature that is in need of my every, you know, I have to do everything for this individual. Right? I have to feed him or her. I have to bathe him or her. I have to, and then not to mention all of the societal expectations, the expectations that you place with on yourself. And so all of it can kind of be very overwhelming.
And my wife, whenever we were having our first child, she read this book called Raising Bebe. And it's this, I can't remember the author's name, but she grew up here in the United States and she moved to France with her husband. And she talks about how different it is in France. And like in the United States, we have this kind of like this cultural aspect where there's an expectation that you are going to sacrifice your life for your child, that you, hey, you like that hobby? Oh, well, you got to focus everything on your kid. And by the way, you got to put them in every sport imaginable and you got to spend money on them. You got to do all these different things for them. And she's like, in France, like your kid's more like along for the ride. Like you do things for them, but it's not like you don't stop doing the things that you enjoy or anything like that. You bring them along and they're expected to, like the raising happens along with that. And like my wife and I joke because we'll have friends of ours or have friends that we've seen or I've seen like aunts and uncles where they have kids and they disappear for like years. And then it's like, hey, then they can come back or like, we'll go to church and you'd be like, hey, what happened to so-and-so? Be like, oh, they had a kid. And like, you'll see them like 2 or 3 years later. And you're like, where are you at? They're like, well, we're too busy raising our kid. And she's like, that is not how it is in France. Like there isn't this expectation that like you're going to sacrifice your entire life to make sure that you're doing everything humanly possible. Instead you integrate them into your life. And I can only imagine some of those kind of cultural, those kind of societal narratives that people get that you're combating whenever you're working with these people.
Absolutely. And you know, that word sacrifice just hit me right in the gut because it's such a true statement that especially women are expected to be the ones that sacrifice for the child. And right. It's so difficult when I'm on the outside as the third party encouraging, you know, self-care and how are you taking care of yourself? Have you eaten today? Have you had a shower? And it's almost like...
I got to sleep for 2 hours. Does that count?
Right? Like, no, ma'am, that is not okay. And yet we almost get badges of honor when we operate like that versus when we say, hey, I'm going to call someone over to watch the baby for a few hours while I get, you know, 5 or 6 hours of sleep. And it's really this thing of...
That's even if it's okay for you to do that, right? Because it might be like, oh yeah, you shouldn't be asking people for help. Like you should be taking care of this on your own. Yes. And hey, you don't get a cookie for, you know, doing what you're supposed to do as a parent, which is, you know, I'm going to admit to everybody that's listening to this right now that I love getting on Facebook and seeing and clicking on comments and seeing people argue. And my wife has shown me some pretty intense arguments in like these mom groups where there is so much shame around, oh, I can't believe that you didn't spend all this time with your kid. Or I can't believe that you needed help with this or anything like that. There is, it is something intense that me as a male, I didn't experience at all. And to see that in a kind of what is supposed to be a supporting setting, I can only imagine what that's like whenever you're working with some of these women.
Well, yeah, and it's not, you know, it's everything from staying at home versus going back to work, breastfeeding versus formula feeding, a nanny versus a childcare center, you know, all of the things. And it's really sad for me because it's hard enough being a woman and a new mother. And so just having this whole shame culture around all of these things, it can be disheartening and at the same time I just tell people it's like that sometimes. It is what it is, and find your tribe. Like, your people right. exist. You just have to find them.
Yes. And, like, gosh, especially some of those things that you mentioned, like, sometimes you just don't ever really know, like, what kind of, like, wars are going on internally for people. And, like, and you're like, well, what's going on here? It's like, well, I told somebody that I didn't breastfeed my child until 5 years old. So, like, I got bashed on the internet or something like that. And you're like, what? Like, oh my gosh. And there are people like that. And so, like, finding those people. Give me an idea. Whenever you're working with some of these mothers and you're trying to help them with that identity piece, what are some of the common things that you're seeing happen, or what are some of the common challenges that they run into? Like, is it all some of these kind of cultural and societal things that we're talking about here, or is it more than that?
It's so complex. It's so many, there are so many things that intersect that sometimes it's honestly hard to tell what's the head and what's the tail, because it all intermingles so beautifully that it's so hard. It's so complex. I just can't even. It is a lot of the cultural, it is a lot of the societal, it is a lot of the self, a lot of what I put on myself based on either how I was based on how I was raised, and either wanting to do exactly like I thought, exactly like I was raised, good, bad, or ugly, or do the opposite of how I was raised.
Right.
And then that's not even counting the partners and their perspective on raising, right? And so it's super complex.
Wait, they don't agree all the time? Yeah, no, I definitely understand that. Now, I know that you said something that, like, sometimes when we have a child or whenever a woman is going through pregnancy or they just had a child, that's whenever some of this attachment stuff that they've learned, that really starts to come up. And tell me a little bit about what are some of the things that you start to see happen.
So, you know, there's this idea, I like to blame the movies and Hollywood for it, that it's all super beautiful and it's all super easy. You know, you get pregnant, you're pregnant for 9 months, it's a beautiful time. You have the baby and it's the instant attachment, you know, you look beautiful with 2 hours of sleep and just crying every 2 to 3 hours to feed and all of this. And the reality is there are so many biological, hormonal and other factors that come into play that it's not easy at all. And with the culture of shaming, with the societal expectations, one of the things that I find that is super challenging is that fear of reaching out.
Yes. Like, if I'm not totally heads over heel in love every second of the day with this child,
there's something wrong with me.
Yeah.
And that's the messaging that we often get and give. You know, I can recall when my first child was born, I was like, oh my God, this is the worst thing ever. Like, who said that this was going to be amazing?
Wrecked my life.
Man.
All right. There are people that are listening to us right now that are shaming us.
And that's fine. I totally accept that. Like, I've come to a place where I absolutely love my children, and it was very, very hard at some point. Right. And, you know, that's just the reality. Even things that we enjoy can be incredibly hard.
Right. I like to think of golf. Right. I like golf, but I don't like it like the first 3 holes. And after that, it's like, well, I already paid for this, so I guess I'm going to continue hitting my ball in the water or in a sand trap. Right. You can enjoy something, like you said, and it's not enjoyable all the time.
Yes.
Especially whenever your kid's screaming and crying and yelling at the top of their lungs. Right. Well, I wonder, I know that this attachment piece is such a huge thing. And whenever we talk about attachment, one of the things that we're talking about is like how we relate, how we connect with people. And sometimes it's safe for us to relate and connect and talk about how we're feeling and what's going on with us to kind of go beyond that surface level. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's not so safe and we just end up staying in that surface level all the time. And we have, especially when we have kids, a lot of those attachment things, they get flushed out, and they get flushed out usually during a lot of intense moments. And I know that you also do a lot of work with like foster and mm-hmm. you said like adopt kids and mm-hmm. stuff like that and their families. And I can only imagine whenever this attachment, this identity piece kind of comes in those type of scenarios, like, well, that has to be really intense whenever you start to see that with these different families that are forming.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, because in those moments, it's all of these different attachment histories that are merging into this big conglomerate, right? And so it's foster adoptive mom's attachment history. It's foster adoptive dad's attachment history.
Right.
It's the child's early experiences. And unfortunately, 9 times out of 10, if they ended up in care, there's a really good chance that that early attachment wasn't ideal.
Right.
And so
they might have a hard time trusting that anybody's going to take care of them or that anybody is going to love them at all.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And how that comes out is through these very intense behaviors and very intense interactions that as a parent or as a child can be very disheartening, because I don't, mm-hmm. I know what I'm needing, but I have all of these blocks up saying, well, no, I don't really need that.
Right. I'm kind of thinking of and reminded of, like I've done some work with, especially like around adoption and different things like that. And whenever you kind of get sometimes where people are like, all right, like I'm going to adopt a kid and like I want this so bad. Like I am just ready just to take all my love and just surround them with it. Mm-hmm. And whenever they do that, because they're in that place and maybe that's what they can do attachment wise. And then they run into a wall sometimes where it's like, whoa, 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 whoa. Right? Some of the kids are like, I've never been able to trust anybody. Yes. Before with this. So that's what you're kind of talking about, like this conglomerate of these different attachment styles and everything like that. And whenever you kind of see that, like, or I may actually be someone that's listening to this now and I may be like, wow, I am that way. I push everybody away. I don't feel like anybody's safe, right? Or I don't feel like I can be close to anybody. Or I can talk about what's going on with me to anybody. What do you do to help people kind of soften that side of them to where it's like, yeah, like, okay, I can allow people in just a little more?
Well, you know, it's a really delicate balance of, you know, kind of giving you that autonomy, that ability to disclose as you feel comfortable, as you are able to know that it's a safe place to disclose. And it's also a little bit of loving pushing, because if I allow you to stay in this place, you're going to, it's comfortable. If I never have to leave my comfort zone, the reality is in most cases, I'm not. And so I have to be able to, we have to develop trust enough for me to be able to push you right there to the edge of your comfort zone, right towards your window of tolerance, if you're familiar with that language, and allow you to go into that space where you grow and learn.
Right. So I do want to talk about that window of tolerance. So whenever we're talking about the window of tolerance, we're talking about this place which you can be, and just like Stephanie said, like where it's uncomfortable, but there is still some level of control. That's usually where we experience the most type of growth, but it's also where we're on the edge of losing control the most. And it's in therapy, we call it the window of tolerance, because the longer you can stay in that window, the more tolerance that you actually build. But it's kind of one of those places where if you stay in it too long or things get pushed too much, then things explode instead. And it's a really cool sweet zone to be in, because that's where the most cool things end up happening. So you try to help. It sounds like you try to help some of these families in these situations be able to lovingly push to help them have that different experience, but not go overboard too much, right? So like maybe me, who's just like ready to surround a kid with just overwhelming love, that might not be the best thing, because I may then push them into like out of their window of tolerance, right? I just threw them through the window and they, you know, they're like, oh, nope, get away from me. Whereas if I'm able to do this in a slower way and a more trusting way, and understanding that like, hey, this is really overwhelming for them, you actually have the opportunity to a different type of experience.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's really, you know, kind of starting out with this awareness that everybody's window isn't the same size. And so if I have experienced instances where I haven't been able to trust, or where I have experienced a trauma, then I may have a much narrower window of tolerance. And so I'm right. going to have to almost sprinkle things into there so that you stay into this safe zone, if you will, without getting dysregulated, without exploding right. or imploding, without, you know, being aggressive or without shutting down. And so I have to sometimes, if I'm that loving person that you're referring to, and I'm a big hugger, I might have to understand that hugs might be too much for this person right now. And so it might be a little pat on the head. It might be a tap on the shoulder or a brush of the hand. So it might be something much less intense that person can then get used to and help to expand their window.
Right. It actually, a couple different things come up for me whenever you kind of talk about that small window of tolerance. One of the first things that comes up for me is whenever working with clients that have some type of sexual abuse history, mm-hmm. a lot of times intimacy and physical touch becomes very dangerous. So a lot of times counselors will work with slowly getting to the place where like, okay, like maybe your hands can touch, or maybe you can hold hands, and then, okay, just taking lotion and like rubbing it on the hand. And then you can kind of like work your way up a little bit, the arm or something like that. You can always try like the shoulder, like slowly sprinkling in, as you're saying, that window. So it's kind of like the window is up here. Maybe it's too small for me to actually go through, but I can kind of look and peek through it a little bit. And then like, as it gets a little bit bigger, then I might actually have the opportunity to start to walk through it and maybe do like a hug, and, or maybe just be able to experience that a little more. I love how you said that, the different size windows, different things like that. So I appreciate that example that you gave. So whenever you're actually doing this, I imagine that there actually has to be a certain amount of, hey, like a certain amount of like psychoeducation, but yes. Also give me an idea after the psychoeducation, is this a lot of like experiential work, or like work where it's like, hey, you got to have an idea what this window of tolerance is. We got to kind of see what it's like here in session, to see what it'll be like at home, or to kind of get an idea. Is that right?
Yes. So for me personally, I draw from a lot of different modalities depending on what the client needs. So in that moment, if you are feeling too unsafe, then we might start with some education and some grounding work. We might start with some education and some mindfulness, things that you can draw, skills that you can draw back on. As you feel yourself getting dysregulated, then you can have the tools to kind of get yourself back into your window.
Right. And what, just for those of you that are listening that are like, what do you guys mean by grounding work? So grounding is whenever we try to pull someone back into the now, pull someone back into reality. So like if I'm sitting there and I'm reminiscing about like, oh gosh, this is what life was like in college, or this is what life was like when I was 5 years old, or anything like that. Sometimes those memories can take us away. Yeah. And we all of a sudden become not as present with what's going on. So whenever we talk about grounding, that's just bringing us back to the present moment. And like, this is what the carpet feels like underneath my feet, or this is just what the temperature of the air is like, or this is what the breath feels like kind of coming in my lungs, doing different things to help us focus on what's happening right now so that we actually don't travel away. And this is very common to do with people that experience trauma or high levels of anxiety. So I imagine a lot of times that you're probably doing this with a lot of different people.
Absolutely.
Like teaching them that grounding work. And I think that's something that's important to mention, like why that grounding is important, is whenever we are in some of these memories, these places that we go to are a lot of times not safe. And the present may not feel safe, but the more and more often that we are in the present and we're not stuck in those memories, the more opportunity we have to be safe. So like, let me give you an example. Let's say that my dad beat me whenever I was a kid. And he used to come home, be mad, and beat the living tar out of me, right? And so I might have learned at some point that like, hey, whenever people get angry, you shut up. Because if you don't, you can get the tar beat out of you. And then fast forward is I get into a relationship, and when my wife gets angry, I shut up because I don't want to get the tar beat out of me, because my body is still responding the same exact way. Yeah. So every time that I shut down, it feels the same way that it did whenever I was a kid getting the tar beat out of me. And whenever I have that reaction, I'm trying to shut down to be more safe, but it doesn't take me to a safe place. So the more and more I can be in that present moment, the more and more I can learn that just because like my wife is raising her voice or anything like that, doesn't mean that my dad is getting ready to beat me up. Doesn't mean I'm getting ready to get attacked. Doesn't mean that I'm not going to be able to be safe. And I think that it's so important, because sometimes we get lost in our mind and we get lost in the experiences that we have. And a lot of times when our body feels something and it like freezes up, it can take us back to that place where things aren't as safe.
Yes. And feeling safe in your body is one of the key components, particularly depending on the types of trauma that you experience. Sexual trauma in particular can really have a lot of those unsafe in your body signals that get sent on a continuous basis. And so going back to our unlearning, right? I'm unlearning these signals, and I'm relearning how to control. I'm relearning that present moment awareness. I'm relearning that this is a body that I can feel safe in with the right things in place.
So I'm sitting there like thinking about a lot of this work and like attachment and identity. And I feel like a lot of us, whenever we think about who we want to be, or we think about how we want other people to experience us and see us, I feel like a lot of us kind of think like, hey, we want us to be more open and vulnerable, or we want us to be able to kind of pass off to other people that like, hey, we really do care about them, or they are important to us. And I wonder, is that kind of a fallacy that I have? Or whenever you're working with some of these people, do you kind of like, yeah, a lot of them actually kind of want to go in that same general direction? Or do you kind of find that people go in all different directions? And some people are like, I feel like I'm too open with people and I don't want anybody to know anything about me or my business or anything like that. Well, what's your experience with that?
Well, I think it depends on the person and their experiences. So we all have different ways that we react to experiences. And we have some of those that are completely shut down. You know, I'm very... your question, yes, no. I'm not adding anything to it. I'm not trying to deepen it. It's just, what do you need from me? I'm going to give you exactly what you asked for, and that's it. And I use that as a way of protecting my inner life. And then you have those people who kind of their reaction is that I'm going to share everything in hopes that you will accept me as I am, knowing everything from the beginning. And the reality is that the sweet spot is somewhere in the middle, because everybody doesn't need to know everything about us. And there are certain relationships that will do better if they know certain things about us.
Well, I wonder, what is it like whenever you're working with people and they kind of get closer to that, hey, this is who I want to be, part that, like, I enjoy my identity and who I am right now. Well, what's it like? Or like, how do you experience them whenever they kind of start to get to that place?
You know, it's really this beautiful transformation that starts to happen as people become who they really want to be. And it's an indescribable experience, really, because you start with this person in this particular place with all of these barriers in place. And as they kind of unburden themselves, it's almost like seeing an injured bird that learns how to fly again.
Right. Right. And it may be a bird that never knew that they could fly before.
Yeah.
Right. It's almost like something magical happens.
It does. And it's all there. You know, part of the thing that one of the misconceptions that I find commonly in therapy is that I'm going to fix it for you. And the reality is that you're fixing it for yourself. I'm just equipping you with tools that you didn't know before, or space to kind of unravel that tangled ball in a way that you haven't maybe been able to before.
Right. I think a lot of the ways that I may think of it is that I could be a really phenomenal baseball player. And even the most phenomenal baseball players, guess what? They got coaches. And usually they have a couple different coaches, right? They got a coaches for like their field position. They got a coaches for the batting, and they got an overall like head coach and different things like that. And they got all these people that are giving them input to help their performance, you know, get better, get closer to what it is that they may want their performance to be. And I feel like for therapy, that's a lot of what it is. It's like, for us in our own power, we are not very good at observing ourselves, and we're not very good at being able to kind of sift through like our thoughts, our feelings, and our experiences and draw some of these correlations, or kind of pick these paths that we go down. And a lot of times with therapists, since they're coming at it from an outside perspective, it makes it easier for you to see like, oh, I do that. Or yeah, that does make sense. And it becomes a really beautiful moment where you can have someone with you that isn't leading you. They're actually guiding you. Yeah. And they're guiding you from behind, actually. And it's like, oh yeah, hey, look at that over there. Look at this over there. What do you think about this? What does this make you feel like? Or different things like that. And it's almost like emotionally focused therapy, which is the work I do when I work with couples. They they don't even always like to call us therapists. They call us process consultants, which means that basically our job there is to help you explore and understand more about the interaction that happens between you and your spouse. Yeah. And all we do is just process like, well, what happens? And I laugh about that because I think, in my opinion, that we kind of do a little more than that. But it is a stark example of the point of a lot of our exploration. And I feel like it's probably like this with you and the work with identity and the and work with just getting an idea of like, all right, how can I be there for some of these kids? How can I be there in these families? Is helping guide them towards where they actually want to be, right? Yeah. If people are involved in foster care, you know, kids, they want to feel loved. Mm-hmm. And foster parents and adoptive parents, they want to care for people and they want to be able to show them that side. And, you know, pregnant mothers, they want to love their kid and they want to be good parents and they want to be good moms. And, you know, and we want to be able to do these things, right? It's not like we're sitting there like, man, I really want to be a shitty parent. Or right. Something like that, right? We're not sitting there saying that thing. And those desires and everything are actually the thing that guide us towards being who we want to be.
Yes. And I like to say it's normalizing that spectrum of experiences. So what good means to you and what good means to me might be different things. And that's okay.
Right. Some parents are okay with their kids getting C's and some demand A's.
Right?
Right. No, that definitely makes sense to me. I kind of wonder, just like while we've been talking about this and really a lot of the work that you do and like how you tie all this together, do you feel like there's something that maybe we didn't talk about or something that you're like, oh, like this is kind of an area too where I tie this in that may be important for us to mention or just to talk about while we're here?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head. We've gone a lot of fantastic ways and it all ties together in this beautifully complex way. And so it's really, you know, going to that trained professional that can really help you move beyond the eye of the storm and be from the outside looking in to help guide you.
Right. Oh, while I was thinking about this, I thought about this earlier and just came back to me. Whenever I was thinking of attachment, I was thinking of competing attachments. And I want to share this quickly because I thought it was powerful. So if you listen to this before, you probably gathered, like I'm a church going person. I do that. And one of the things that I heard the other day that really just struck me is we have an attachment to, you know, I have an attachment to a higher power, right? I have an attachment to God. And that is an attachment that I'm always working on. It's something that shapes my decisions and everything. But you know what? I also have attachments to other people. And so whenever I was thinking about this. So the other day I do what I normally do on Sunday is I go to church, or right now I'm videoing into church. And I had someone else that's like, hey, yeah, like you want to meet up and you want to, you know, talk or anything like that, or just kind of have some food or do a Zoom chat or something like that, just to hang out. And I was like, oh no, like, you know, I got to go to church and, you know, I'm going to go ahead and like zoom in and, you know, kind of work on that attachment piece. And whenever I said that, the message that they got was that that's, you know, I'm not very important to Craig. And Craig may not really care about me that much, which of course is not the message I'm trying to send to them, but you know, that's the message that they received. And it runs up against their attachment things, right? So like even my wife, this happens sometimes. Whenever I'm like, you know, hey, I got a, you know, our son is in there. I'm going to play with him. I'm super excited to see him, especially when he's doing cool things or whatever that may be. And then she's like, you know, you don't really spend as much time with me as you used to, or anything like that. Then you're like, you have these competing attachments that sometimes make it hard for us to navigate different things, because, you know, I want to make my parents proud of me, but at the same time, I may not also agree with everything that they do or that they believe. You know, I want my wife to love me, and at the same time, she drives me crazy with some of the things that she does. So like, sometimes we have these competing things that go on, and it's really normal that we have that. But I think it's also really important, because sometimes the competing parts are where the most friction comes into, and we get the opportunity to explore and understand that more and more, right? We get to hold two things at once. And I think that's just so important, because some people may be listening to this and they're like, you know, they think their identity is a single aspect, but it may not, right? I can be a person of faith, and at the same time, you know, I start to question things, or I start to wonder things about the society and the world that we live in. You can hold those two things at once, even though they may pull at each other and they may tug at each other. And I wonder, you probably see that a lot, like these competing attachment things in people individually. And I know that we didn't kind of name it like that, but I wanted to call it that.
Yes, no. And I didn't even think about it like that. So thank you for naming that. And you're right. I see it all the time, particularly with children from trauma experiences and how high their needs are, and kind of how it ties back to that attachment. And when I have parents, oftentimes it's a mother figure that has a similar attachment style. And so how that shows up in the interactions can be very, very difficult.
Right.
You know, a lot of that, I give a lot of education, a lot of normalization. We all have competing values. We all have competing priorities. I like to give a lot on communication and how am I making this other person aware of what I need and listening for their needs.
Right. Even whenever you talked about that with like kids, and I think about this all the time with like foster kids and different things like that, is, you know, they may have that attachment need that most of us do, which is that, you know, we want love from like our mothers and fathers, and we want that part. And at the same time, the experience you may have is that I can't really count on mom and dad. And so you have this competing attachment where you may get into a foster family, or you may get adopted by a family that really truly loves and cares about you, and they show you all that, while at the same time you're like, you have this drive, this part of you that wants to pull you back towards your family, even though logically you may know like that's not a good place for me to be, I don't want to be in that place, but you have this thing that pulls you there, this attachment need that pulls you there, while at the same time you're like, well, I'm getting love and care and stuff that I need, but you start to push at that, or you kind of start to leave that there in favor for this, or vice versa, right? You kind of go to that and you're like, you throw that away. That, imagine you get to see that all the time.
Oh man, that competing loyalty is really, really challenging, because in a lot of ways, the current caregiver can very easily go into this place of feeling unloved and unappreciated. For all the things that they are depositing into this child. You know, a lot of times this competing loyalty in children comes out in this way of testing. You know, if I do this to you or if I do that to you, are you going to throw me away?
Right.
And so, you know, it kind of, that kind of starts to go more into a lot of those kind of core belief type worldview type, core value type thing.
How deep is your love and care actually for me?
Ooh, yes.
Right. No, I think that is so important. And, you know, a lot of you that may be listening to this, when we talk about these competing attachment needs and everything, you're like, oh gosh, I totally understand that. And some of you that are listening to this that may have these experiences, you get confused, just as confused as everybody else. And it's just as hard as everybody else. And it sounds like working on that identity piece and exploring and understanding these parts of you really helps you in those times where to understand everything that's going on when you're feeling both of these tugged at you. Yeah. I think it's hard because sometimes get to the place where they feel like, hey, that just is what it is. And it, you know, saying that it is what it is just a lot of times just a cop out.
Yes.
Right.
I don't want to do the work.
Right. Or like, I don't want to do the work, or I feel like there's nothing I can do.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we're here to tell you, like, yeah, no, there is the something that you can do. And a lot of it is exploring these parts of yourself and understanding how they impact you, and understanding how other people have these parts too. And they are different than yours. Yes. So Stephanie, it's such a wonderful gift that you're able to come on here and talk with me about this, especially since I thought that we were actually going to end up talking about something a little bit different, but us talking a little before we started recording, I think that this turned into a conversation that I really enjoyed, and I really appreciate you sharing this time with us. I'm wondering if someone's listening to this and they're like, you know, this Stephanie gal, she sounds like something that I would be interested in meeting with, or I really want to know more, understand more about my identity, or about like how I can handle some of these attachment relationships, and just really, really kind of dive into some of this stuff. Stephanie, how would someone get a hold of you, or what might they kind of seek to be able to get in contact with you?
Yes. So I have a website that my practice has a website where you can find all of my contact information, all of my email, my social media. And that website is www.spectrumofhealingllc.com. And I don't know if you do show notes or something so that we can type that in. That's a lot of words, but
all right. Spectrum Healing LLC. Is that what you said?
Spectrum of Healing.
Spectrum of Healing. Okay. Perfect. And, on that website, would they be able to find your email there as well?
Yes. That's the most direct route to me. My email is there. My phone number is there. My social media is there. Everything.
All right. Perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. And I really appreciate you taking the time and sharing your expertise.
Thank you so much for having me. I really, really appreciate it.
And thank you all for listening to this episode of Mental Health Insights. If you guys have any questions, more than welcome to reach out to Stephanie or myself and ask those questions away. And again, I hope that you enjoyed the episode and find it helpful. So until next time, we wish you well and to stay safe. Thank you for listening to our show. This podcast is designed to provide accurate and reliable information, and those that appear on the show are all licensed professionals in the area of mental health counseling. We are in no way rendering legal or medical advice, only information to help serve you better in making decisions in your life. If you need a professional, you should find one. The music you are listening to is called Lobby Time, and that is by Kevin MacLeod and licensed through Creative Commons.